Welcome to the Traverse City National Writers Series. Over the course of the next hour, you will hear excerpts from the fourth event of the 2010 schedule, An Evening with Tom Brokaw. Mr. Brokaw is a distinguished journalist, former anchor of NBC Evening News, and the author of a number of New York Times bestsellers, including The Greatest Generation. The Traverse City National Writers Series is an exciting new event bringing some of the brightest celebrities of the literary world to Northern Michigan. Founded in 2009 by Doug Stanton, the National Writers Series is dedicated to hosting great conversations with some of today's best authors, journalists, and premier storytellers. The series founder and moderator of tonight's program, Doug Stanton, is at the podium preparing to introduce Mr. Brokaw.
Almost 9 years ago, I was about to publish a book I didn't think anyone would read, called In Harm's Way, which is about a World War II ship, the USS Indianapolis. I was at home. Oh, thank you. I was at home and the phone rang, and it was my friend, Dave Scroppo. "Dude," he said, "turn on Larry King. Tom Brokaw's talking about your book." And I was confused because I had no idea why Tom Brokaw, whom I'd never met, and whom I didn't even know had a copy of my book, why he would be talking about it. "Dave," I said, "have you been drinking?" "Yes," he said, "but he's still really talking about your book." I turned on the TV and there he was, paying a compliment to that book. But even more important, he was paying homage to the men whose story I was honored to tell. And it was that act of generosity that brought enormous attention to the stories of those men and really helped launch even further their ordeal into the American consciousness. On another level, that was perhaps the kindest thing anyone had ever done for me professionally, and it literally changed the course of my life. I decided then that if I had a choice, and I realized that I did, that in my own writing and whatever advantages it offered me, that I would try to leave more on the table than I took. And however imperfect my attempts, I would be aware that the men and women I write about are the ones who've done the hard work of living, of having survived whatever ordeal they've lived through, and that my job is simply to be the teller through whom their stories pass. In this challenge, I heard echoes of the stories of the veterans I'd met, and I've heard it since from veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I also heard echoes of my own parents' voices. Be patient, listen, and no matter how little you have enough to give someone else something. The writer series is dedicated to this spirit of support, and I imagine right now there is someone walking down Front Street who's wondering how in the world they're going to make a living as a writer or even what to write next. And if we've done our job here correctly in this room tonight, and when we leave here, perhaps we can be part of answering that challenge. On the other hand, we're lucky enough because no one has been more encouraging to others in this journey than tonight's guest, Mr. Tom Brokaw. Please welcome him now.
Thank you very much. Thank you. The fact is, Doug, whenever you go on Larry King, it helps to be drinking. So. Authors love Larry King, and I'm very fond of him personally. But Larry's been doing it for so long, and he does it so often during the week, that sometimes his attention flags when you're on the air. So you find yourself out there able to say anything that you want to about your book. You can engage in high praise for your work. You can pick out what part of the question you want to answer. And Larry sometimes just kind of checks out. And then occasionally, he decides that he ought to make a show of getting back involved in the interview. So one night I was on Larry King talking about The Greatest Generation and World War II, and telling I was in the middle of a very poignant and moving story, and I could see that Larry was going to come back too again midway through the story, so I kind of steeled myself. And he leaned over and he said, Tom, just a minute. World War II. I said, yes, Larry. He said, that was a really big deal, wasn't it? And I said, I can't disagree, Larry.
So you could have talked about books I hadn't written.
Let me take a minute or two and tell you how I came to write The Greatest Generation, and then I will undergo the withering cross-examination of your fellow citizen. I was born in 1940, so my first memories of life are of World War II. We were living on an army base, and my first conscious memory is about people going to war, guy next door, young guy who was in high school, and he would play with me and entertain me, and then he was in uniform and he was going to war. Just across the street were two Sioux Americans, native Sioux, who were heavily decorated in the European theater, and they came home on leave. And as they deserved to, they got roaring drunk for a couple of days. And everybody up and down the street just said, leave them alone, they're going back. And there were trucks being driven by women. I can still see to this day a woman getting out of a big 8x10 truck with a bandana, wearing a pair of overalls and carrying a lunchbox. And that was my first impression about women being able to do things other than what they were expected to do in those days, which was to stay at home and clean and do the cooking. We were at an ordnance depot, so they were exploding ordnance, ammunition, and bombs out in the southwestern South Dakota prairie every day. It was like having your own homegrown fireworks show. And I thought the war would go on forever because that's all I had ever known. I wore a helmet to class, and I ran up and down the ditches and fought the Japanese and the Germans, the imaginary enemies coming over the prairie, and then suddenly it was over. And I moved to the central part of South Dakota in a very remote area on the edge of an Indian reservation, where my father went to work for the Corps of Engineers, and they were building big flood control dams and hydroelectric dams in those days in the middle of nowhere. And because of the can-do spirit of World War II, and what they learned to do in short notice, they would build a town seemingly overnight. They would literally build a town within 2 years, a whole town. It would look like an army base. It'd have paved streets and curb and gutter and a movie theater and a hospital and a hotel and a very good high school and a shopping center and then a lot of government housing. And we had the best house we'd ever had. It was one half of a duplex with 3 bedrooms, 1 bathroom. And my parents just couldn't believe their good fortune. My dad was making a pretty good wage. And we had all these opportunities surrounding us because we were in the boom time of the 1950s. And from all over America, workers came. And they were able to buy their first new car and buy something called a deep freeze and to have running water and to have indoor toilets. Many of them had never had that before. And they were making good wages. And they were able to buy their children real Christmas presents and not have hand-me-downs. So there was this almost palpable sense of optimism and of celebration of the goodness of American life, and we began to take it for granted. And, you know, I caught the good wave and married a wonderful woman. In 1962, we went off to Omaha, to Atlanta, to Los Angeles, and before too long, I was making 5 times as much as my father had ever made. I was able to travel the world, and I ended up in Washington, and then I'm the White House correspondent, going to the White House State Center. Now I'm in New York, and first I did the Today Show, and then I was the anchor of Nightly News. And in 1984, we decided that we should do the 40th anniversary of D-Day, Normandy. And I was a pretty keen student of American military history, so I said, absolutely, let's do that. And I was also thinking with the other side of my brain, man, this is going to be great. I'm going to be in Normandy for a week, eating great French food, drinking good wines and calvados, and running through the countryside. And I went, and we had lined up a representative group of veterans, 2 guys from the Big Red One, the 1st Division, a couple of guys from the 82nd Airborne, a military chaplain, and one of the Rangers from the 2nd Battalion, one of the boys that pumped a hawk that took the cliffs. And we met them for dinner the night before, and they just seemed like everybody who'd ever raised me. I mean, I was just so familiar with all of them. They looked like the guys that I knew at the American Legion Club or at the Vets Club, and I thought, boy, this is going to be a piece of cake. And I walked down the beach the next morning, Omaha Beach, with the two guys from the 1st Division, one of them who later earned the Medal of Honor, and the other one who later lost his legs in the Battle of the Bulge. And as we stepped onto the beach, I looked over and saw their wives. They were clutching their handbags. They had kind of plastic headdresses pulled down tight like everybody I'd ever known growing up. They'd got new permanents the night before. And the men were wearing their American Legion windbreakers. And I said, tell me what happened. And they stopped, and they lowered their voices, and they began to describe the horror, June 6, 1944. They were 19 years old. And when the ramp went down on their Higgins boat in the first wave, their lieutenant and their first sergeant were shot dead before they hit the water. Now these guys were on their own. They rushed ashore as best they could, threw themselves down on the sand in a state of stark terror, and couldn't move. And one of them, Gino Murley, said, but there was a 34-year-old colonel who came loping down the beach like in a morning jog and said, come on, boys, we've got to move forward. We can't win the war here. We've got to keep going. And he said, that gave us enough courage to go to that bluff. And one turned to the other and said, do you remember what was going on there? And he said, I'll never forget it. And I said, what was that? And they said, well, that bluff had been laced with landmines, and a sapper unit had gone in advance to detonate them and to mark the trails. Given the chaos of the moment, many of them had stepped on the landmines, shattered their legs or their arms. They just simply rolled off to the side, shot themselves up with morphine, took a cigarette break, and instructed us to come on and told us, walk there, don't walk there, walk there, don't walk there. And when we got to that top of the bluff, about noon, we thought we'd live this day. And we knew that from then on in our lives, we would live it one day at a time. And they fought every day for the next year. Well, by then, in the first 90 minutes of filming, my life had been changed. And I realized how much we owed those two men and the millions of others who had shown such great courage in European theater, North Africa, the beaches of the Pacific, the skies, on the seas and beneath them. And I went back a kind of shaken person, and then I heard Bud Lamel's story, one of the boys at Punta Hawk. Then I heard from the 82nd Airborne, and by the end of the week, I went home and said to my wife, my God, we have no appreciation of all that our parents went through and their friends went through. And I began to collect the stories, not quite knowing what I was going to do with them. I began calling the parents of high school friends and coaches and men that I'd known growing up, remembering that they'd been in the war, and had them tell me their stories, and I began to use them in commencement addresses, keeping notes. By the 50th anniversary, 10 years later, that was a memorable time when Ronald Reagan stood on the cliff and talked about the boys at Punta Hawk, and at that point he was talking about my friend Bud Lamel. I was going on the Today Show, and I thought a little bit about what I wanted to say, and I said out loud to Katie Couric, you know, this generation, in their formative years, went through the Great Depression, when life was all about sacrifice, common cause, and deprivation, and going without. And then, just as they got into their late teens or early 20s, they were asked to go to the far reaches of the Pacific and into the bitter cold of Europe, into the burning sands of North Africa, and fight these two monstrous military machines. And we were not really prepared to get into that war. 1940, the United States was the 16th military power in the world. We had more horses than we had troops. And then I said, you know, Katie, they came home and they could have put down their weapons and gone back to their hometowns and said, I've done my share. But they didn't. They went to college in record numbers. They got married in record numbers. They built new industries and gave us new science and new art, and they never stopped giving back. I believe, I said, it's the greatest generation any society has ever produced. And when I finished, I thought, God, I wonder if I've gone too far. And I was unhooking my microphone, and Stephen Ambrose was pounding me on the back, saying, if you don't write that, I will. The greatest generation. That's the phrase. And I said, well, I've been thinking about it. So I proceeded to collect more stories and put it in book form. And my publisher had some reservations about the title, The Greatest Generation. God, are you going too far? Can we market that? Is that something that's defensible? And in a meeting with the publisher at the time, I came up with a phrase that I've continued to use. I looked at her and I said, that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
From the Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan, you are listening to the fourth event of the 2010 National Writers Series, An Evening with Tom Brokaw, on Interlochen Public Radio.
Had Ambrose published Band of Brothers yet?
Pardon me?
Had Ambrose published Band of Brothers by this?
Band of Brothers came out about the same time. Band of Brothers came out a little bit after. This all came out in 1998. I was finishing this book. Unknown to me, Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks were making Saving Private Ryan. So in August, Steven called me and said, I'd known him. He said, I'd like you to go to a screening of a new film. And I went, and it began, and I looked at Meredith, and I said, oh, my God. There's simultaneity here that no one could have anticipated. But Band of Brothers came out a little bit after that, as I remember. And no one knew what to expect. I wrote it in about a year and a half because I was working on something else, and this book was just continuing to press me. And I went to the publisher and said, I want to change, and I outlined what I wanted to write, The Greatest Generation, and they said, stop everything and go write that. It came out in time for Christmas of 1998. I had never written a book before. I didn't know what to expect. And there had been a lot of chaos along the way. My editor's husband had died midway through the book, and so I lost her. I was finding my way through this new process. But a couple of friends of mine who had written books stepped in, read the galleys, came back to me and said, there are a couple of things that you need to clean up here. But by the way, it's going to be a bestseller. I said, how do you know? They said, just trust me. So it hit the bookstores in December. And as Doug knows, that's a terrifying moment for an author. You've poured your life into something. Are people going to respond? And I was telling Doug earlier today that it was selling at the rate of one every 90 seconds for a long time. And it stayed on the bestseller list at number one from December of that year, well into the spring, more than 6 months. This is not as immodest as it sounds, because my most heartfelt belief about my role in this book is that I was a doorman. I opened a door and said, there are stories here that we all need to hear. And America was ready to hear them. And the veterans, for the first time, were ready to talk about them.
Did it change your reporting pre-Greatest Generation, post-generation? I mean, did you start asking different questions about Americans you met in general, having gone through that transformative experience on the beach?
No, I don't think so. I think I was a true reflection of their values personally and saw my life through that prism. I do remember during the 60s, the great conflict in The Greatest Generation, which I later came to Greatest Generation. One of the stories that I tell about the 60s is, imagine if you're a Marine who's gone through World War II. You dropped out of school in Detroit at the age of 17 and joined the Marine Corps. And then you went to Iwo Jima, and you went to Peleliu, and you went to Okinawa, and you came home. And you married the girl down the street, and you went to work for the Ford Motor Company on the line. And you caught the good wave. You got the good benefits, the good wages. You got the good pension program. And by the mid-1950s, you bought a house. That was unheard of in your family. And you had two children, a boy and a girl. And they had more things than you ever could have imagined as a youngster. And before too long, you bought a little fishing cabin in the Upper Peninsula somewhere. and you got a boat to go with it, and you'd spend your weekends coming up here. And then one day in 1967, you come home for supper, as we called it, and it's 5:30, and it's time to watch Walter Cronkite or Chet Huntley and David Brinkley. You still have a crew cut. Put your lunchbox down in the kitchen, sit down at the kitchen table, and you look up, and your daughter is sitting there with hair on her legs, because it's not, it's, if you want to be liberated, you don't have to shave your legs anymore. She's not wearing a brassiere or any other undergarments. And she's got a boyfriend who's wearing his sunglasses inside and seems not to have shampooed or cut his hair in the last 4 years. And his name is Zeke. And he plays in a heavy metal band. And she said, "Daddy, Zeke and I are going to move in together, but don't worry about it, I'm on the pill." Now he looks to his son, who's sitting across the table, for some help. And his son is sitting there with an American flag with a swastika over it, with America spelled with a K. And he said, "Dad, I'm not going to fight no war in Vietnam. I'm headed for Canada. I'm going to burn my draft card." This old Marine turns around to his wife, looking for some kind of assistance. She's got her hands on her hips behind him, and she says, "Hey, big guy, how come I'm the only one who does the dishes around here?" That's pretty much a portrait of what was going on in a lot of households in America. Now, having said that, they all got through it together somehow.
Right.
And the wounds were healed later, and they were able to find their way back together as families, and they all learned from one another. And that's part of the resilient strength of this country, I believe.
1968, is there... That's a cataclysmic year in your book, Boom, which is your most recent book. Have we had our 1968 in the 21st century? I mean, are we headed for it?
We've not had a 1968 because the wheels completely came off the system. People, in a lot of ways, have, I suppose, modified their memories of that time. A lot of people on the left have said that was the most glorious year of my life. A lot of people on the right have said it was their worst year in the history of the country. It was mostly a time of enormous turbulence in which all that we believed in was tested. It began with Lyndon Johnson saying, "We're turning the corner in Vietnam and the American economy is strong." Within a month, he'd been successfully challenged by Gene McCarthy in New Hampshire. And he was forced to go on national television and announce he would not be a candidate for re-election, for renomination. This proud Texan, who had won in a landslide just 4 years earlier, after he had succeeded John Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy gets into the race. Dr. King, who had led nothing less than a moral crusade in the South and had gotten the Civil Rights Act passed, and now turned himself to economic opportunity, was trying to hold off very radical and violent elements within the civil rights movement, goes to Memphis to stand with the striking sanitation workers. He is murdered in cold blood on a motel balcony. And America goes up in the inner cities. In Detroit, Washington, D.C. almost burned down. In Los Angeles, all across the North, all across this country, the inner city went up. With the exception of Indianapolis, where Bobby Kennedy had arrived that night, made the announcement, and talked passionately but coolly about how violence is not the answer, and kept that city intact. And then Bobby Kennedy wins the California primary the first Tuesday in June, thanks his supporters, flashes the peace sign and says, "On to Chicago," steps into a hotel kitchen corridor, and he's shot at point-blank range by a deranged young Palestinian who believed that he was not sympathetic to the goals of the Arabs in the Middle East. And Bobby Kennedy dies within 24 hours. This is June of 1968. By the end of the year, 15,000 young Americans died in Vietnam. We had riots in the streets of Chicago at the Democratic Convention. We had a three-way race for president that year. Richard Nixon, who who had taken himself out of politics in 1962, was back in with a new strategy to make the Republican Party the dominant party of the American South, to play what he called the silent majority, portray himself as the statesman with a plan to end the war in Vietnam. And Hubert Humphrey, the happy warrior, who had been the liberal conscience of the Democratic Party, was now stuck with the Lyndon Johnson war legacy, trying to remain loyal to his friend, but at the same time expressing his own doubts about the wisdom of our policies in Vietnam. And a third man was in the race, George Corley Wallace, the governor of Alabama, who came out of that state on a stream of hateful invective, preaching the gospel of violence and bigotry, and attracted a considerable following. And then that year, in November, Richard Nixon was elected, but just barely, and promised to bring the country together, but instead gave us Watergate and six more years of Vietnam. But we got through it. We managed to heal the wounds over a long period of time, to learn some lessons from all that we'd gone through. There were fissures everywhere. A lot of people look back in the 60s and think really it was represented by a young hippie girl dancing in Golden Gate Park to the strains of James Taylor in the background while a guy's off to the side hitting on a bong, getting completely stoned. But there were young men every day going down to enlistment offices and raising their hand and volunteering to go to Vietnam as well as answering the draft. Construction workers wearing hard hats who didn't have the advantage of a college education or the deferment that came with it were reporting for work every day. People were still going to church on Sundays, and merchants were opening their doors and trying to keep America moving in the same direction. So that was a traumatic time, and I don't think we've had anything quite like that in 2000, in the 21st century. As desperate as the attacks of 9/11 were, and we're still playing out the consequences of them. But that was a very substantial, profound challenge to the fabric of American life.
Mm-hmm. Talk about Watergate for a moment, because I know some of the many people in the audience have a fascination with that. And you were you at the White House then?
I was at the White House during Watergate.
You moved there in 72?
I got there in 73, the summer of the hearings. Well, Watergate sneaked up on us in a way, they might have gotten away with it, although it's hard to believe it if it hadn't been for Carl and Bob, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, two young, new kinds of reporters who really believed in shoe leather and weren't part of the Washington Press Institution going to lunch every day and hanging out with the power brokers. So when I got to the White House in the summer of that year, there was a general belief that now that the hearings were over and that Haldeman and Ehrlichman were going to go to jail, that the president probably had dodged a big bullet. And it was going to be probably okay. Here's an amusing story. One of the first things that I covered in August of 1973 was a press conference given by Spiro Agnew, who was said to be under investigation by the FBI for corruption during his days as governor of Maryland. And he went out and he gave a bravura performance, answered all the questions. Everybody came back and said, isn't it refreshing that we've got at least one public official who's willing to stand up and answer the questions? And the next day I went over to see the Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, and I said, Vice President yesterday and covering the White House. Are we through the worst of it, Mr. Attorney General? Knock on wood, Mr. Brokaw, we're through the worst of it. He later told me that he had in his desk the indictment that they were about to prepare for the Vice President of the United States, who had been stealing everything except the toilet paper in any public party where he had been. And then it just began to unfold day after day after day. You know, we went through the Six-Day War in the fall of 1973. You would go with the president to various public occasions. I remember going to the Southern Governor's Conference in September, late September. He said there, the worst of it is past. He went to Disney World, and he said, the country deserves to know whether the president is a crook. I'm not a crook. He was so beleaguered and so determined to show that he was not what a lot of people thought that he was, that he decided to go out to his home in California and not take government aircraft. So he got on a United flight. Can you imagine this? The president of five Secret Service agents got on a United flight without telling anyone. And we knew that he was trying to dodge the press as much as anything. And so I flew through the night on another red-eye flight so I could be outside his San Clemente gates the next day, which I knew would not please his staff at all, reporting on where he was and what he was up to. And there was this long kind of drip, drip, drip water torture that the country was put through. It was a real constitutional crisis. I didn't know how it was going to turn out. I didn't know whether we'd survive. There was a time when I didn't know whether Richard Nixon would call out the troops to defend the White House. And then, of course, by the summer of 1974, he was withholding the tapes, and the Supreme Court ruled that he had to give them up. And within 48 hours, a smoking gun appeared, as we all suspected it had been there all along, and it was. And it was, in many ways, a surreal week. I got home one night about midnight, and Meredith had left out some cold chicken. And I was reading the transcripts of the tapes. And she leaned over me and said, "Honey, those are historic documents, and you've now got chicken grease all over those pages." And I went on the air the next day, and then I went down to the White House when Richard Nixon was going to be making that tortured farewell to the staff in the White House. And I have these odd memories of Tom Gerrold, the White House correspondent, had gone on vacation just before the tapes came out, before the Supreme Court decision. And he'd run into some shopping center in Maryland where he lived to get a haircut because he was going to have to go on the air. And I'm here to tell you it was the worst haircut I have ever seen in my life. And we were standing in the East Room of the White House, and nobody in the press corps was saying anything about Gerald's haircut, waiting for the president, when Ron Ziegler, whose life is now over in effect because he's defended the president, then comes bustling into the East Room, stops, wheels around, and says, "Gerald, that's the worst haircut I've ever seen." And I watched the president walk out, escorted by Gerald Ford, throw up his arms in that victory salute that he thought would irritate everybody, and fly off. And within 24 hours, Gerald Ford had said, "Our long national nightmare is over," and the country moved on.
From the Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan, you are listening to the fourth event of the 2010 National Writers Series, An Evening with Tom Brokaw, on Interlochen Public Radio.
Before you came, I watched some of the video on the internet about the 9/11 coverage you did. You write poignantly about that in your autobiography, A Long Way From Home, standing in your apartment and being able to look at the skyline. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that was the single hardest day, and it was more than a day, but that one day was extremely difficult. And for all the obvious emotional reasons, but also as a professional journalist, with all of you out there looking in, saying, "Help me, I need to know what's going on." And we didn't know. There had been no preparation for that. There was no active body of intelligence that we could turn to and say, "This is where they came from and what happened." It was unexpected. At one point, early in the morning hours, sometime, I believe, before the towers went down, I looked into the camera and said, "This is war." And there had been no declaration of that yet. I said, "This is the most serious attack on the United States since the War of 1812. Hawaii was not yet a state when Pearl Harbor happened. This will change us." And then a few minutes later, I was watching the towers, and I grew up around construction. And I looked into the camera and I said, I hesitate to say this, but those towers are going to have to come down at some point because there's been so much structural damage. And then I thought, don't do that. Don't say that. That's going too far. And 4 minutes later, they came down. I didn't anticipate that they were going to come down that day. I can't say that. And with every passing 15 minutes, there was more trauma to report, more uncertainty about what was going on. And if you do what I do, and I'm a pretty emotional guy, you kind of operate on two different planes. You try to be as professional as you can, get the information right, say it in a coherent way so people can understand what's going on, but you're always kind of taking your own temperature. Am I okay? Am I going to get through this? Do I make sense? And I kept worrying that I was going to break down because the stories, one after another, mm-hmm. were more poignant. And I was doing fine until about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. A guy called in, he'd been in Tower 2, and he was on the phone with us. And I said, give me a word picture. What happened to you when the building was hit? He said, I rushed out to the elevator bank, they weren't working. And he said, I saw the fire escape stairs. And I ran to that door and I turned around and I have 4 co-workers who are confined to wheelchairs. And there was nothing I could do for him. And he started to cry. And I'm always especially touched by people who are confined to wheelchairs because I'm an active outdoorsman. And they always show the kind of courage I doubt that I would have. And I thought, this is so cruel. The last moments of their life after all that they've been through, that this building was breaking up around them and they didn't have a chance. I went home late that night, as I described in the book. I looked out our library window and I could see the glow in the south of the continuing burning, and I had a big drink at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it went straight through me. It had no impact whatsoever. Adrenaline is a very strong drug, it turns out, and I thought, maybe I'll have another one. And then I thought, if I do that, I may not be in shape to get through it. So the next morning, I woke up after about 5 hours of sleep, completely electrified, ready to jump out of bed, and the phone rang, and it was my assistant, and a very dear friend of mine is a New Yorker writer by the name of Kelvin Trillin, Bud Trillin, and his wife had been in the hospital awaiting a heart transplant. And she died the night before, and it was like family. And it was cathartic for me. I cried for 45 minutes. My wife was out of Montana at the time. I just sat in my bedroom and cried. And it was, in a way, a relief valve. And then I jumped in the shower and rushed back to work, and the rest of it's kind of a blur, frankly. I mean, I don't remember details hour by hour by hour. We were just on the air constantly trying to keep track of this. About 6 weeks later, I went back and looked at my calendar to see where I had been before 9/11 happened. 9/11 happened on a Tuesday. And it turns out that on the preceding Friday, I had been in Washington as a guest of Mrs. Bush at her first National Authors Celebration, that she had all the authors that she enjoyed and others come. And I was one of the featured readers on Friday night. At the Library of Congress, a black tie audience of the diplomatic corps and the leaders of Congress with David McCullough. It was a hugely important moment for me, personally. I felt so privileged to be there as one of the two readers, and I was reading from The Greatest Generation. And then we had a wonderful party afterwards, and the next day I came back up to New York, and on Monday it was raining desperately. And we were supposed to, I was helping honor a young climber who is blind, who had climbed Mount Everest. You know Eric, you know who he is? Mm-hmm. And we were gonna have a breakfast for him at the top of the World Trade Center on Tuesday morning. But there was a problem with the schedule, so we had it in New York in Midtown on Monday night. And it was pouring rain. And I went down and introduced him, and it was a small gathering. And I'd completely forgotten about the schedule. And if we'd been at the World Trade Center in the cafeteria, none of us would have survived because no one there did. And I later said to Mrs. Bush, you know, I remember being at the White House and then at the Library of Congress reading on the Friday before 9/11. And she said, yes, and earlier in the week we had a state dinner for the President of Mexico. Now remember, they'd only been in office since January. So she said, that's what I thought the presidency was all about. State dinner, author's luncheon, and then she said, then it was 9/11. So it was a very traumatic time, obviously, for the country. I'm not sure that we took full advantage of the spirit that existed in the weeks and months after 9/11. I thought there was a rare opportunity for both parties, frankly, to come together and say that we're now joined in common enterprise here. Some sacrifices will be required of all of us, and we'll have to find a way out of this.
Yeah, you've talked about that, about the lack of sacrifice that's been asked today of families in relation to the books you've written. But I just have one thing, because I was thinking maybe the audience is interested. When you're sitting there and information is coming into your head and you're on camera speaking to 16, 20, how many people? Millions of people. Do you know?
That night, we did take, they didn't do ratings that night because everybody agreed to suspend them, but we had a way of finding out. And the three networks, I don't want to go into the specific numbers because it's kind of unfair, but the three networks had close to 100 million people watching them. NBC had a few more than the other two did.
Well,
that's as far as I want to go.
Thank you. Because
there are
a lot
of people watching, and you're aware of that, but you don't sit down in the chair and say, oh my God, there's this mass of people out there watching me.
Well, no, that's my question. What are you thinking? Because you're looking and you're saying, you know, this is war. And I'm thinking, you've been on the beach at D-Day, you've interviewed these veterans, all that stuff is informing your internal compass.
You have one thought, and that is get it right. I'm not overstating it. It's just, please, let me get it right. And I'm double questioning everybody who brings anything to me. They say something in my ear, I'm saying, are you sure? They say, we're going to have an opportunity to interview. I said, that's not relevant. Let's not go there. So there's this dialogue that goes on that you don't hear when other reports are on the air. I did say later, and Dan and Peter and I talked about it as well, and we had a common reaction to it that had not occurred to us until much later. I was at that time, I wish I still were, I was 61, and it took everything I knew as a journalist, and as a father, and as a citizen, and as a human being to get through that day. Everything I knew. I had familiarity with the Middle East, I knew the Twin Trade Center towers, I had written about America going through other traumas before, I knew what families were going through, because I'd been a father, I was a father, and I could only imagine what it was like to have a mother or a father or a child working in one of those buildings. And what I tried to do was to keep it contextual, keep perspective, as well as deliver the facts. And I dare say, I'm not being disingenuous about this, I thought it was a remarkable tribute to all the news out, that everybody stepped up and did a fantastic piece of work. And one of the advantages of having this wide screen that we now have is you've got a lot of different places that you can go. I'll tell you one very quick story. I'm a friend of Ted Turner's. I'm a big admirer of Ted's. He's a great guy to know because you never know what's going to happen next with him at any given moment. But he's an absolute genius when it comes to information and how it ought to be disseminated. After all, I invented cable news. And he had stepped away from CNN at that point, but he still has his penthouse apartment in the CNN headquarters in Atlanta. And Walter Isaacson was running CNN at the time. So he called, or Ted went down into the control room and looked up, and there was CNN with its coverage on the air. But there are a lot of channels that are part of the Turner Broadcast, and TBS and all those other channels, movie channels and everything else. And Walter said, I think we're doing pretty well. And Ted says, you're doing pretty well. Put the CNN feed on all of our channels. So TBS and everybody carried CNN, so no matter where you went across their spectrum, you got the news. And that's the time when that's all you want in society. Mm-hmm. You just want information. You have this enormous thirst for it.
Tell us about your thoughts on Greg Mortensen, Three Cups of Tea, the author of Three Cups. He's been here.
Oh, he has been here?
Yeah, he's been here twice. And he has a lot of fans here. And I know, I just want to tell the audience for a moment, when Greg, we want to bring Greg back because he's well respected. But what people don't know is that he sent out 1,000 letters fundraising to everybody in media, entertainment, Hollywood. The only person to send him a check back was this guy right here. But
now, wait,
as Greg says, it was only for $25, but
it was $100.
No.
It was $100. He wrote to me, and I think maybe I'd been tipped by it. This is kind of a complicated, but in the end, kind of an amusing story. I think I'd been tipped by a mutual friend that I had played football against in South Dakota, who was a member of the Lutheran Church where Greg worshipped in Minnesota. And then it turns out Greg had been coached by my old high school football coach. So I think Don may have said to me, this guy is going to write to you. Don insists that that's the case. Anyhow, I read he was a climber, that he'd been working in Afghanistan. Oh, this is worthwhile. I'll send him a check for $100. So I did. Now the book comes out, and he writes in the foreword, and continues to write in the foreword. I asked 1,000 celebrities. The only one who responded was Tom Brokaw, who sent me $100. I have a daughter who's an emergency room physician in San Francisco. She was a Schweitzer fellow in the middle of Africa. She worked in Peshawar, Pakistan, when the Russians were in Afghanistan, treating Afghan women. She has treated refugees in camps in Thailand, and she looks at me and said, that is an outrage. You get all that attention for $100, Dad. That's two martinis and a hamburger in New York. Yeah, you get all that attention for. She's still furious about it. He's the real deal. He's the real deal. He probably knows more about winning hearts and minds than anybody else that we have in Afghanistan at the moment. And Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, an admiral, came to me about a year ago and said, okay, my wife says, I've got to meet with Greg Mortensen. What do you think? And I said, I think it's a great idea. And so they invited Greg in to do a briefing for the Joint Chiefs. And Mike told me later that he said it was one of the best briefings that we'd had about the culture and what people respond to in Afghanistan. Since then, I've worked with his family, and we've produced a videotape, and he just lists me. Because if he's been here, you know, he doesn't have a natural stage presence. I mean, you know, he is what he is. I mean, he was a climber, and he's the son of Lutheran missionaries. Went to the University of South Dakota, so we share an alma mater as well. And he is just determined to go do good work. And sometimes it's a strain on the family because he's gone for a long time. Foundation is now based in Bozeman, Montana. And it's totally thrilling for me to see that paperback book as high as it is, not just because I get the credit for the $100, but that it stays there. And students now are required to read it at the Claremont Colleges and at Northwestern, I think, incoming freshmen. So that's a great tribute.
You mentioned you was a climber, and I know that you love the outdoors and you love to fish, and you have a very good friend who's a climber. What's that relationship like? How we see you, most of us in the audience see you as someone who's been on TV, but I know that you spend a lot of time running around outside.
The short story is that I grew up on the prairie hard by the Missouri River, and my closest friends when I was growing up were Indians. Sylvan Highrock and Jerry Onefeather and Billy Bad Moccasin, and we'd hunt and trap and fish. And
Elmer Ashes. Elmer, was there an Elmer Ashes too?
Elmer Ashes. You remember Elmer Ashes as well. And that was a big part of my life. And then I got to be in college, and I thought, I want bright lights, big city. I want to get out of the prairie. I want to get from out of these small towns where nothing is going on culturally, and I want to be in Los Angeles and New York and where things are happening. And I got there. And after I'd been there for a while, I loved it, but I missed the open spaces. So Meredith and I started going back. First in California, we went into the mountains doing backpacking trips, just the two of us. I think it had a little something to do with getting away with kids who were 2, 4, and 6 at the time. My mother and father would love to come out and stay with them. And then we moved to New York, we'd go to Colorado, and we'd take the whole family now on camping trips up in the mountains, or we'd get a place and then go off on day hikes. And then we started doing Montana. And I got intrigued by the climbing culture, and I had a friend by the name of Rick Ridgway, who was the first American to climb K2. And he came back, and I put him on the Today Show. It was the last time any mountain climbers were on the Today Show. I put every one of them that came along on. And Rick said to me, why don't you come out to Jackson Hole this summer? And Yvonne Chouinard, who is a legendary climber, he is the combination of Ted Williams, Michael Jordan, and Jack Nicklaus as a climber. And we'll teach you how to climb. And I thought, God, I just can't resist doing that. I had no idea what I was getting into. And I went out there, and I was in very good shape. I was running a lot and working out. And I kind of showed up like this rube saying, okay, what do I do? And Doug has had his own Chouinard experience, so he knows what this is like. And Yvonne said, well, you're in pretty good shape. That's pretty good shape. So, okay, we'll go climbing tomorrow. And we paddled across the lake. They borrowed a pair of climbing shoes for me. And I went out to something called Baxter's Pinnacle in Jackson Hole as part of the Exum School. And they said, do whatever we do. Just pay attention to what we do to it. Severe climb was a 5.7 climb, and I was able to do it by kind of mimicking what they were doing. And then they got to the top. We got to the backside, and Yvonne said to Rick, why don't you go do free climb that little spire up there I put in this thing? And Rick said, yeah, maybe I'll get roped up, and he puts a rope around him. He fell 60 feet past me. And what did I know? And I turned to Chouinard and I said, how often does that happen? And Yvonne said, that's the worst fall I've ever seen anybody survive. And I thought, I'm putting myself in their hands. 2 days later, we're going to climb the Grand in the Teton Range. And we're going to climb not the easy route, but we're going to climb the direct Exum route, one of the 50 classic climbs in America. So they were going off to, on the way up, they went off to make another little climb. I went on my own, got up to the hut, and I'm there thinking, is this a good idea? Should I be doing this? And a bunch of 20-year-old guys who were in the advanced climbing class, they'd been in training for 3 weeks, came up with their guide. They were going to do the easy route. And they said to their guide, why can't we do the direct Exum route? And he said loud enough for me to hear, you're not ready yet. I'm doing it after 8 hours. It worked. And then we went off and did a lot of things. We went to South America. We climbed the Coos Glacier on Whitney, and we went ski mountaineering. And Yvonne is my spiritual brother in a lot of ways. He's very important to me. We're extremely close friends. And he's been hugely influential in how I lead my life, you know, because he constantly disapproves of anything that is not raw and wild and a little bit dangerous. And I think about him a lot. And we've done a lot of things together. One time, we were in the back country above Yellowstone in the middle of the winter doing a winter climb. And I had just gotten off the plane from New York 4 days before, no acclimation whatsoever. We just plunged in. And by the third day, I am exhausted. I'm just worn out. And we're now getting ready to ski out. And they spot this peak that had been not climbed all winter and it had beautiful virgin snow. And they said, let's go climb that. And I said, I'm going to pass. And Yvonne said, no, come on. And I said, okay, I got a virus. He said, no, come on. I said, I've got AIDS. I'm not going to do it. I was making up anything that would work at that point. I'm going to die right here. So they went off and did it, and we did it. One of the stories is that we were climbing a glacier climb in Mount Rainier in Washington, and I had never ice climbed before at that point. I had what we called the 2-minute Chouinard lesson on crampon use before we began. And so I was doing fine. It was the second day, and we came to a very precipitous, very steep, like 80-degree drop, and it was all black ice, and we had to get across it to get to the route to continue on. And if you made one tiny misstep, you were 4,000 feet down the mountain. So I turned to Yvonne and I said, "We rope up here, right?" He said, "Are you kidding?" He said, "If you go, we all go. You've got to get there on your own." I think you can still find my crampon marks in that ice. I was in so deep as I went across, I can't tell you.
Yeah, he's really an inspiration. I mean, right. If you folks don't know his mission at Patagonia, one of the reasons that we met is that I went on to South America with Yvon Chouinard for Men's Journal magazine, and I showed up like a rube, and I said, "I'm going to bring all this gear, this cups and pots and pans," and I said, "Do you want me to bring you anything?" Because he said, "No, I don't use a sleeping bag." And I said, "Really?" He goes, "How about a tent?" "No, I don't use a tent." And I said, "What about a frying pan?" "No, we don't need a frying pan." We had nothing. We took no food and no gear. And I said, "What about food, Yvonne? It's about 3 weeks and we're at the tip of..." He goes, "Don't worry, it'll show up." And and it did.
No, it's... And listen, we were at the foot of Mount Moran one time, and we were going to field test some new Patagonia gear. So we had numbers on the back, and we didn't have sleeping bags. He said, "We're going to go real light and just flash them out tomorrow morning." And we bought one submarine sandwich for the two of us. And we went in at 6 o'clock at night. We were going to climb all the next day. And he said, "We just want to go real light." So we didn't have sleeping bags. So, you know, I had my gear on, and nighttime came, and I crawled down and snuggled up against a log. And a cold front went through. And it got down to about 35 degrees that night. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, I was over kicking him. And I was so angry at him, saying, "What the hell were you thinking? There were no sleeping bag." And he kind of rolled over and looked. He said, "Yeah, it got a little colder than I thought it was going to." And we ended up climbing this route on Mount Moran, and it went very well, and I'd been doing a lot of it at that point. And he finally said about three-quarters of the way up, "Hey, let's drop the ropes. You can free climb this." So we climbed it free all the rest of the way up. And I get to the top, and there are two guys from town who live in Jackson Hole. They're completely roped up. And then Yvonne said, "Well, we don't have time to hang around. We're going to go back down." We start free climbing back down. And he's so skilled. He's way ahead of me at this point. I'm making my way down this cliff, no ropes. And finally, these guys have turned completely ghostly white. And their eyes have gotten about this big. And they kind of crabbed their way over to me. And they said, "We're not going to be responsible for watching the anchor of Nightly News die on this mountain." They said, "You have to put this rope on. We're not going to allow you to go on. We're going to hold you here if necessary." So we climbed down together, and then we had a whole other epic day.
You've been listening to An Evening with Tom Brokaw during his recent appearance at the Traverse City National Writers Series. The next guest in this series is poet and fiction writer Thomas Lynch. For ticket information, please visit the series website at www.nationalwritersseries.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, this is Aaron Stander.